Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we delve into Venezuela's political crisis. You've heard the headlines. We'll talk about it with Iowa State University political scientist Amy Erica Smith. Also, about Brazil's controversial president and how he's alarming many climate scientists. Sat in our second half hour. In our first half hour, an abundance of news from the courts this week we want to cover. Several actions by the U.S. Supreme Court. Also an action here in Iowa, a judge striking down the fetal heartbeat law as unconstitutional under the state's constitution. Joining us to this half to make sense of these court actions. Paul Gauder is with us, professor of law in the College of Law at the University of Iowa. He teaches constitutional law. Paul Gauder, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Scott Peters joins us from Cedar Falls, where he's associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Scott, welcome back to you.
Good to be here.
Those Supreme Court items we want to get to, of course, the Supreme Court order regarding transgender, the transgender military ban, lack of SCOTUS action on DACA, and also the Second Amendment case that the Supreme Court has taken up. But first of all, let's look at this fetal heartbeat bill. It was back last year in 2018 that Iowa's Republican-controlled legislature passed this so-called fetal heartbeat bill. It's a bill that outlaws abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. Often that's at 6 weeks, many times before even a woman has realized that she is pregnant. Tuesday of this week, this law, which I think our guests will agree, Paul, is the most restrictive abortion ban in the U.S. currently?
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was declared unconstitutional by a district court judge here in Iowa, Michael Huppert. He wrote it violates the Iowa Constitution. Explain the decision.
Well, so this was actually a no-brainer kind of case. And the reason is last year, at the end of last June, the Iowa Supreme Court made a ruling that people had been expecting for some time, I think, which was that in addition to a right to abortion under the federal Constitution, there's also a right to abortion under the Iowa Constitution. And then the court said that the right to abortion under the Iowa Constitution is actually stronger than what the U.S. Supreme Court had interpreted it as under the federal Constitution. And so with that ruling, I mean, I think it was manifestly clear that no Iowa court can let an abortion law this restrictive stand. And so this ruling shouldn't be a surprise to anybody.
Mm-hmm. No surprise, Scott Peters, but I guess there's no doubt that this legislation from the very beginning was aimed at triggering a challenge to Roe v. Wade from that landmark decision in 1973.
Correct, but what's interesting about what the Iowa Supreme Court did is by grounding its decision in the Iowa Constitution, and by making the protection stronger, as Paul noted, it can't be appealed in federal court.
Mm. Paul, is it the way you see it?
Absolutely right. The U.S. Supreme Court has no review power over Iowa's decision about interpreting its own constitution unless somehow something in the Iowa Constitution violated the federal constitution. It certainly can't review Iowa's decision to give more rights to its citizens through the state constitution than the federal constitution does.
So had this judge grounded this, made the same ruling but grounded it differently, it could have reached the Supreme Court?
Theoretically, I mean, so the appellate path, even if the district judge had grounded it on the federal constitution, would have still gone through the Iowa Supreme Court, and presumably the Supreme Court would have said, in addition to the federal constitution, remember our ruling last June, it also violates the Iowa Constitution, and so it probably would have been stopped in its tracks anyway.
Mm-hmm. What are your other thoughts about this, Scott Peters, political dimensions for you as a political scientist?
Well, one thing that's notable is that the Iowa Supreme Court's decision last year, striking down the waiting period that set the set the table for this recent district court decision on the heartbeat bill. That Iowa Supreme Court decision, that was a 5-2 decision. Now, one of the justices who was in the majority has since retired, but even if that new justice, Justice Christensen, who replaced him, even if she would switch sides, it would still, you know, that majority is still solid at 4-3. So, you know, it's highly unlikely that if the state chooses to appeal this up the chain in the Iowa judiciary, it's really highly unlikely that the Iowa Supreme Court will reconsider its decision from last year.
Paul, do you see any repercussions for other states and other state laws that have different abortion restrictions in their laws?
Not necessarily. So the thing about the Iowa Supreme Court is, number one, it's just, you know, among state judiciaries, it's extraordinarily well-respected. I think it's widely understood to be one of the least partisan, polarized state Supreme Courts in the country. And so I think in terms of Iowa, what that suggests is that regardless of the change in justices, we would expect it to hold. But I also think that it would be hard to transpose. I mean, certainly there's a persuasive force to, okay, Iowa made this decision. Other courts thinking about their own state constitutions might be persuaded by the rationale. But I wouldn't put a whole lot of weight on that.
Mm-hmm. Reviewing some court moves this week with Paul Gowder of the University of Iowa College of Law, Scott Peters, the Political Science Department at the University of Northern Iowa. Let's move on to the U.S. Supreme Court. Three significant moves there this week. By a 5-4 decision on Tuesday, the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court granted the Trump administration's request to bar most transgender people from military service while cases challenging this policy move forward in lower courts. Now, it was in 2017 that the president announced this ban and his reason. He said then that American forces couldn't afford the, quote, tremendous medical costs and disruption, unquote, of transgender service members. There are policy makes exceptions for those already serving openly and those willing to serve, quote, in their biological sex. Scott Peters, how much of a surprise is this action this week?
You know, I guess I would say not too much of a surprise. There were actually there were several injunctions nationwide on the ban from transgender troops serving. The Supreme Court's decision yesterday meant that two of those injunctions are lifted. And the government can once again enforce the ban, but there's actually still another injunction that's in place. I would assume that will be lifted soon, but there was a federal judge in Baltimore who also issued an injunction. That judge is currently reconsidering the motion to dissolve the injunction, and I would anticipate with the Supreme Court decision he'll do so. What it really indicates is that there's a pretty good chance that when this case works its way back up the appellate process, if it gets to the Supreme Court again, when the justices are actually considering whether this is legal or not, whether it's constitutional or not, or legal to ban transgender soldiers, that there are probably five justices who at least see some merit in the Trump administration's argument.
Well, what do you think, Paul, let me put this to you, about the arguments that the Trump administration has made that the American forces couldn't afford this, quote, tremendous medical costs and disruption of transgender service members?
I mean, the substantive argument seems honestly a little bit silly, but I'm not a military expert. What I do want to point out, though, is I don't think we should read a lot into the court's view of the substance of this question from this action today. And the reason is because what these nationwide injunctions, as they're called, where district court judges say, okay, this federal policy is now barred everywhere in the United States as to everyone, they're incredibly controversial within the law. And they're controversial for reasons independent of the substance of whether or not transgender discrimination is gender discrimination, whether or not it's rational for the military to think that this is some kind of overwhelming cost. The nationwide injunctions themselves might have been what the justices were concerned about rather than the substance.
And this has been a trend, these injunctions being more plentiful?
Absolutely. They've increased radically in recent years, and many people...
What's driving that?
So it's a difficult question, right? I mean, obviously, some of what's driving that has just been there's more constitutional litigation about what the government does. But there's a real tension between, on the one hand, the idea, okay, you've got a court ruling that the government's doing something illegal. It should just stop the government from doing that thing full stop. And on the other hand, the idea that the trial courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, that they really should only be dealing with the specific cases before them. And so I think just litigants have shifted their strategies toward asking for these kinds of injunctions, and there's been a pushback.
Mm-hmm. When we look at the actual practical effect of what the Supreme Court ruled or did this week in this case, reading from the New York Times article and quoting Aaron Belkin, the director of the Palm Center, a research and advocacy group that focuses on sexuality in the military, he said that while it is unfortunate that the Supreme Court has allowed military discrimination to be reinstated, it's critical to understand that the military is not required and has no need to reinstate the transgender ban, which would cause destabilizing whipsaws in personal policy. Scott, so actually the impact on the military and our transgender servicemen and women is little at this point.
I think that's probably true, at least as I understand it. I would disagree with Paul a little bit, though, on the prior point about not reading too much into the fact that the injunction was lifted. I agree on the larger point about these nationwide injunctions being very troublesome. But when we look at the Supreme Court's response to these nationwide injunctions, we see a pretty partisan response to it. And in fact, in this opinion, the four liberal justices would not have lifted the nationwide injunction. And I think we've seen similar things with the immigration decisions where nationwide injunctions have been put in place. Even some of the previous Obamacare decisions, I think there was a partisan tint to some of those about whether those injunctions stay in place or get lifted. It goes beyond partisanship, but I think there's a pretty clear partisan bent here.
Scott Peters is with us of the University of Northern Iowa, where he teaches political science. Paul Gauder, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. I want to get to another couple of other actions taken by the Supreme Court this week. The news is it took no action in the Trump administration's plans to shut down the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. We call it DACA in the news. It shields some 700,000 young undocumented immigrants from deportation. So, Paul, how can this be no news is big news or some news?
You know, the thing about – this is maybe a general theme of what I have to say today, which is I think my crystal ball for what the Supreme Court is doing with these kinds of decisions is very cloudy. I think everybody's crystal ball is very cloudy. So you know, if I can compare myself to Socrates for a moment, at least I'm the person who admits that he knows nothing. So I have no idea what to read.
Scott, let's go to you. Your crystal ball any clearer than Paul's?
On the DACA one, I don't know. That one's a little cloudier, I would agree. This is a little bit of a more traditional non-decision, as we would call it. I mean, this is just the court deciding not to take up a challenge at this point. So, again, it's sort of, you know, letting the process play out a little bit longer, letting more cases be heard. Here, they very well might be hoping for a political solution where they don't have to weigh in at all.
Well, DACA is in the talk about the solution to the shutdown, right? That's a poker chip.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The other thing about this case is that the lower court's decisions were basically about the administrative process. So if you look at what the lower court said, essentially they said the Trump administration should have explained itself better under the Administrative Procedures Act before they tried to reverse DACA. And so this is the kind of thing where I think, unfortunately, if you happen to be a person who likes DACA, the executive has the capacity to essentially go back and redo its efforts, and perhaps the courts won't have to, or the Supreme Court won't ultimately have to hear the question at all.
Let's tackle the final Supreme Court move this week we want to get to. The U.S. Supreme Court said it would hear its first Second Amendment case in nearly a decade, a gun issue case. It's one that involves a New York City law that limits residents from transporting guns outside their homes. Scott Peters, you take the lead on this. What's the significance of the Supreme Court taking this case?
Well, this is the first major case dealing with firearms that the court has heard since, I believe, 2010. In 2008, it issued its big Heller decision in which it said, really for the first time, that there was an individual right under the Second Amendment to possess a weapon. In 2010, it made clear that that extended to the states as well. Now, with this case, we have kind of a unique law. I don't know how many other laws there are like that, and we can talk a little bit more about what that might mean. But all signs point to the court taking this case in order to expand the right to carry weapons under the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. In this New York City law, it limits residents, Paul, from transporting guns outside their homes. A very specific law here.
Yeah, and it's a very strange law. So they can take guns outside of their homes to licensed gun ranges, but they have specific authorized gun ranges, and they have to be within the city. And so it's very weird, right? Like somebody can take their gun to a New York City gun range, but not to a, Albany gun range or something. And it's just, I think that what the Supreme Court, well, at least I hope what the Supreme Court is trying to do is really to flesh out at the very least what it thinks an impermissible gun regulation is. Because the thing about the two cases that it has handed down, Heller and McDonald, is they didn't really tell us very much. Basically, they said, okay, there's an individual right. It applies to the states. There's something about self-defense involved. But
right.
Then, and so the circuit courts have gone all over the place. Like, none of the circuit courts have any idea what the standard is.
Mm-hmm. So, in talking about gun laws and the cases that the Supreme Court chooses to take or not, Paul, I wonder, is it an outlier compared to other sorts of cases that come to the U.S. Supreme Court? I mean, has the U.S. Supreme Court perhaps been avoiding these types of cases? We normally have cases, don't we, to kind of pinpoint what a law means and what it doesn't in its interpretation before a court. Is the same process happening, you think, with these gun laws?
Again, with the caveat that, crystal ball, very cloudy, I do think that some of the chaos in the lower courts could be driving really the timing more than anything. Like, I don't think any of the circuit courts really have any idea what the Second Amendment standard is for reviewing a gun law. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court never gave us one, and so the courts have just kind of been struggling. And so it may well be that they've just decided, okay, we've seen that we haven't given them enough guidance. Maybe it's time to actually do that.
Mm-hmm. Scott, talk a little bit more about the political dimensions here. Of course, this comes at a time when gun laws are highly controversial in this country. Last year, we saw so many tragic school shootings. We saw a campaign by youngsters in this country, also here in Iowa, showing their protest of the gun violence, I guess, broadly speaking. And there is big money in guns. The NRA supports this lawsuit. Talk a little bit more about the political dimensions here.
Yeah, I mean, there the timing is also interesting, right? Because when we look at the last 4 or 5 years, you know, since Sandy Hook, we've seen a lot more state laws restricting gun rights. At the same time, we've seen other states kind of going the other way, expanding right to carry and things like that. So we see this huge variation in regulation from state to state right now. And Paul's absolutely right. The Supreme Court hasn't been giving guidance on exactly what kinds of regulations are permissible under the Second Amendment. When the court made its decision in Heller, it inserted this language that this decision doesn't get in the way of longstanding prohibitions of certain types that states have passed. And so the appellate courts have kind of been struggling. Some appellate courts have said that there is a right to carry outside the home. Some haven't. Meanwhile, politically, states are enacting all kinds of new regulations.
And we have here in Iowa, do we not, Scott, our own legislature wanting this session to have its own state right to bear arms amendment, right? And we had a snafu there.
That's right.
Bureaucratically, that will delay that, right?
That's absolutely right. There was the process of amending the Iowa Constitution is pretty lengthy, pretty burdensome, and you have to have resolutions in two sessions of the legislature in a row, and then it can get put up for public referendum. But in between, it's got to be listed properly and announced properly that it's been approved by the legislature, and that didn't happen, and so they have to start that process all over again. And so, yeah, there are the Republican legislature here in Iowa has been expanding gun rights in different ways and wants to actually expand the constitutional basis of gun rights.
We have just a few seconds left. I mean, when we talk about this being interesting in that it's the first Second Amendment case to be heard in nearly a decade on the Supreme Court, also several justices on the Supreme Court, of course Kavanaugh, but perhaps Kagan, others, this will be their first go-around with gun rights, won't it, Paul?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't expect a whole lot of surprises, though. I mean, honestly, I'm gonna make a bet. I'm gonna try my crystal ball.
It has cleared suddenly. Cleared suddenly.
My shaky crystal ball says no massive expansion, but some actual clarification.
Okay.
We'll see.
Okay, that's less murky than we had before. Paul Gowder, professor of law at the College of Law at the University of Iowa. Scott Peters, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Scott and Paul, we appreciate your insights and your expertise. Thank you so much for joining us this half hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you both.
Coming up in just a moment, my guest is Iowa State University political scientist Amy Erica Smith. Her expertise lies in Latin America, so we'll delve into Venezuela's political crisis you've heard in the headlines. Also, Brazil's controversial president, how he's alarming many climate scientists with what he said this week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.